All right, good afternoon. We'd like to get started, if I can have your attention, please. I'm Richard Thomason, Director of the Healthcare and Coverage Program for Blue Shield of California Foundation. I want to welcome you all to today's briefing on the Affordable Care Act in California, year one and beyond. So we're here today to present the results of the California sample of the 2014 Kaiser Survey of Low-Income Americans and the ACA, which was funded by Blue Shield of California Foundation. This is the second year that we've supported the California sample of this national survey, which looks at how low-income Americans are taking up health insurance coverage, how they're using care, and experiencing barriers to obtaining care, and the impact of coverage on their financial security. So we think it's really important to stop and look at how the ACA is faring in California, because our implementation of the law is so important, really, for the national conversation. California has embraced the law by expanding Medicaid, by creating our own marketplace, Covered California, to provide subsidized coverage to individuals. Over 4 million Californians have gotten coverage through the ACA, and we continue to be a bellwether for the nation to see the impact of the ACA on the health of our residents. So before we get started, I wanted to thank the staff of Kaiser Family Foundation and Blue Shield of California Foundation, who created the terrific research you'll be hearing about today. First, I'd like to thank the report's authors from the Kaiser Family Foundation, Rachel Garfield, Melissa Majorol, and Catherine Young, and on my staff, Rachel Wick, Program Officer for Blue Shield of California Foundation, who helped to shape the California results. I'd also like to thank Rakesh Singh from KFF and Christine Mulhart and Kimberly Weber from Blue Shield of California Foundation for their work in putting today's briefing together. So today's briefing is not only live here in Sacramento, California, but it's also being webcast and live streamed on Periscope, which you can find in the KFF Twitter feed. So good luck with that. So first today, we'll hear results from the survey from Rachel Garfield of the Kaiser Family Foundation. After Rachel, we'll be joined by Jennifer Kent, Director of the Department of Healthcare Services, for her observations about how we're doing in the second year of this historic coverage expansion. Jennifer has to leave a little early, so we're going to make time for Q&A with her after her remarks. Following the director, we'll have a panel discussion about California's successes and challenges with ACA implementation with a great group of folks. So now, for more information about the survey results, I'd like to introduce Rachel Garfield. She's a senior researcher and associate director at the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, where she's responsible for directing data analysis on insurance coverage and access to care for low-income populations. So she'll walk us through some of the detailed findings and highlights in the report, which is being released today. Rachel?
Thanks so much, Richard. I'm really pleased to be here today to present some of the findings from our survey of what's been happening to individuals in California during the first year of the ACA, or what happened to them during the first year of the ACA. What survey results are really wonderful for is illuminating broad patterns in what's been happening and helping us move beyond some of the anecdotal evidence that was popping up during the first year of coverage. But it's really up to the people on the ground who are implementing this law to help us interpret those findings. So my role today is to present those patterns as a setup for our speakers who will come later on and talk about what it means for ongoing policy implementation in the state. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with the Kaiser Family Foundation, we are an independent health policy research organization. And in the words of our president, Drew Altman, we're really in the information business. One of the challenges we identified when we were thinking about how to study the ACA was the lack of timely information on people's experiences under the law. And so we wanted to undertake original data collection to try to capture this information. And our goal was really to move beyond the enrollment numbers. There are other excellent sources of how many people enrolled in either Medi-Cal or Covered California, specifically the administrative data that the state collects. But we wanted to be able to get some data that told us, how are people faring? How are they using the healthcare system? What impact has coverage had on their lives? And for those who remain uninsured, what's been happening to them? And so you can see on this slide some of the broad aims of the program, of the study. As Richard mentioned, the California sample that I'll be talking about today is part of a broader effort at the Kaiser Family Foundation that includes a national sample as well as some other state-specific samples. And we were in the field in the fall of 2014 with most of the interviews done before the start of the second open enrollment period, so we could really ask people about that first year of coverage. In California, we had a very robust sample with over 4,500 non-elderly adults participating in the survey. Now, there are several reasons why the Kaiser Family Foundation was really interested in doing a California-specific survey. And it's not just because California is our home. We're based in Menlo Park. But it's really because, as most of you know, the ACA is really being implemented at the state level. And so you need that state-specific policy context to understand the findings. We chose California because it really is a bellwether state for ACA implementation. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the specific steps that the state has taken to really be quite aggressive in implementation of the law. And while the state did experience some of the glitches that were experienced nationwide during that first year, the state showed remarkable enrollment numbers during that first year. I think they were pretty unexpected. And it leads it to be a wonderful case study for examining what happened under the law. So let me get into some of the findings. The findings that I'm going to be presenting today are part of a broader report. There is an excerpt from that report in your packets. And the full report is actually available at kff.org. We also have a few copies available for people to pick up on their way out if they like. I'm only going to be able to really skim the surface today, so I would encourage you to take a look at that if you have a chance. One of the first things we were interested in was, who are the people who gained coverage in 2014, and who are the people who were left behind and remained uninsured? And on many important measures that we looked at, specifically income, age, and health status, as I'll talk about in a second, these groups were very similar to each other, actually. But there were some differences between these populations, some of which I've highlighted here in this slide. You can see that while the majority of both groups are in families with a worker, the newly insured are actually less likely to be in a family with a full-time worker than the remaining uninsured. As you know, the ACA opened up new coverage options for people outside of employment. People who had primarily part-time employment before the ACA had few coverage options, and so perhaps that has changed under the law. Importantly, we see some differences in race ethnicity of the two groups. I know there's been a lot of attention to this issue in the state. And while Hispanics had large coverage gains under the law, we do see that the remaining uninsured population is disproportionately of Hispanic race ethnicity. And this is self-identified by the respondents in the survey. There are several possible explanations for this. One is limits on eligibility related to immigration, which affect primarily people of Hispanic origin. But others are barriers related to language access or cultural barriers to coverage that I'm sure our panel will talk about. Last, we saw some differences by gender. And these actually reflect some longstanding patterns of women being more likely to have coverage than men. And we actually see that in the population that gained coverage versus those who didn't. When we dug a little deeper into the data on that, we think that some of this may be related to actually Medi-Cal eligibility, which is still higher for women, for some women, specifically pregnant women. And a lot of people who gained Medi-Cal in 2014 were actually still qualifying under those old eligibility pathways that were in place. Many were newly eligible, but people are still coming in under those old pathways. Now, as I mentioned, we also looked at health status, and I wanted to drill down to these results just for a second. There's a lot of data on this slide, and I want to highlight two key takeaway points for you. The first is that there was a big concern before implementation that there would be selection among the newly insured. That is, that the sickest people would be the ones to sign up for coverage. When we looked at the data, we actually did not see significant differences between those who remained uninsured and those who took up coverage in the share who say that their health is poor, either their overall health or their mental health. And this leads us to think that perhaps selection wasn't as big an issue. The second major takeaway from this slide is that we find that there's still a great need for coverage among the remaining uninsured. Many of them are telling us that they are in poor health, and so that would indicate a need for some kind of coverage and health services. Notably, they're also less likely to tell us that they have either a diagnosed illness or are taking a prescription. Based on other research, we think this means that people are less likely to be linked to care, and there are possibly high rates of undiagnosed illness among this population. One of the most interesting questions that people were asking before implementation was what's going to happen to care patterns. This was really a big unknown, what people would do once they got their coverage. And we asked a host of questions about where people go for care, what their utilization was. And what we found was that most people who have a usual place that they go for care tell us that they did not change where they went for care once they got their coverage. We see that just under 1 in 5 of the newly insured say they did change their care. In follow-up questions, most people said this was related to insurance, but that still means that about 80% stayed with their previous provider. And when we look at who that provider was, we can see the ongoing important role that clinics and health centers are playing in caring for this population. The majority of the uninsured population and a plurality of the newly insured population tell us that they rely on either a clinic or a health center for their ongoing care. So these providers are continuing to play a very important role in caring for both the uninsured and low-income insured population in the state. Now, on most measures of access that we looked at, we actually find that those who gain coverage did better than the uninsured. This is not a surprising finding, as anyone who's familiar with the past 30 years of research in this area knows, but it's nice to see that the law is working as planned. That said, we did identify some areas for policymakers to perhaps pay attention to moving forward. When we asked people, did you postpone care? And if you postpone care, did you ever get it? We actually find that the uninsured and the newly insured are reporting similar rates of having those challenges, and that these are higher than those who have been previously uninsured. And I'm sorry, I should have defined earlier. The previously insured are people who had coverage before 2014 and continued to have coverage afterwards. There are several reasons why we may see these patterns. Most of the newly insured are lower income, and there are barriers to accessing care for people who are lower income related to traveling to care, getting time off of work, all sorts of things like that. It could also be related to more complex health needs among the lower income population. That is to say, if you have more potential encounters with the healthcare system, there's a higher likelihood that one of those may be potentially problematic for you. In addition, we also identified some system challenges, and you can see these in the results on the right-hand side, for which we don't see differences by insurance. We actually see, it looks different, but they're not statistically significant. We actually see similar rates of people telling us they had problems either getting appointments or had to wait longer for appointments among the newly insured and those who had coverage before. So these may be indicative of just larger challenges in the healthcare system, not related necessarily to the kind of coverage that people have. Now, the last set of outcomes that we wanted to focus on were related to financial security. Health coverage has two major goals. One is to help you access coverage, and the other is to provide financial protection from that coverage. And we find that health insurance is working in this capacity. Both the newly insured and the previously insured tell us that they have fewer problems with medical bills and greater financial security against future medical bills than those who remain uninsured. That said, there are some areas to pay attention to moving forward. Specifically, nearly half of the newly insured population told us that they believe it's either somewhat or very difficult to pay their monthly premium. Most of these individuals are in covered California, since Medi-Cal enrollees generally do not pay any premiums for their coverage. And although there are affordability provisions in the law, perhaps some ongoing attention to the suitability of those provisions is warranted. Last, I just wanted to reiterate that the financial concerns that we raised are really the ongoing challenge that the uninsured in the state are facing. There was a lot of attention in 2014 to implementation and the need to get it right to get people coverage. But when we asked folks who remain uninsured why they remain uninsured, very few people indicated that it was some sort of logistical challenge in actually getting enrolled. Very, very small share said they either didn't want coverage, they opposed the law, they were against the idea of the ACA. Some did tell us that they sought coverage, but were told that they were ineligible or that they knew they were ineligible because of their immigration. But the most common reason people tell us that they don't have insurance coverage is that they simply can't afford it. And so given the availability of financial assistance for most people who remain uninsured, perhaps some ongoing help in helping people be aware of these new options or making sure that they actually are affordable to them would be important. In conclusion, I just wanted to leave you with some of the policy implications that we drew in the survey. In the name of time, I won't read these to you. I'll just leave them to you to peruse. And most of them I've actually already touched on in my previous comments. But in summary, I think I'll just say that while there were significant coverage gains under the ACA and the newly insured population is faring better than they were before, that is to say they have better access to care, better financial security, there are some ongoing areas to pay attention to, and I look forward to hearing from the panel about some of the things that the state has done during 2015 to continue its progress. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rachel, for sharing those interesting findings. So in the interest of having Jennifer Kent here and out on time, we're going to hold questions for Rachel Garfield until later on in the session so that we can bring up Jennifer Kent, who is the appointed director of the California Department of Healthcare Services as of January of 2015. She oversees a staff of 3,700 people at DHCS, and among other things, is responsible for the operation of Medi-Cal, the state's Medicaid program that supports the health of more than 12 million Californians. So, a big job. So, we're so pleased that Jennifer could join us today.
Thank you. It's good to see you, and thank you for having me. I think, you know, what's really phenomenal when you think about a program such as Medi-Cal in California, obviously it's the largest Medicaid program in the country, but when you sit, at least this is what I do when I sit at home by myself at night, and think that there's 12 million Californians that are out there that are better because of what you and your department and the administration and policymakers are doing for them, but then it's also the same thought, which is, oh my gosh, there's 12 million people that rely on this state to help provide coverage for them and their families, which is a really amazing both opportunity and challenge. In preparation for this discussion, I think it's really important that we take a look back just for a little bit to understand where Medi-Cal was prior to the Affordable Care Act and where it is today, which I think coming to this department for the third time, I served in 2004 to 2007 and then basically for a little bit in 2011 and then I'm back for my third tour of duty. I got to kind of see both the pre-ACA department as well as the post-ACA department, and I think it's just really phenomenal to think how the program has changed as well as the department itself. And so kudos to our research and analytics division who gave me some of these facts. But when Medi-Cal enrollment was taken in October of 2012, it was 7.6 million individuals. And then today we stand at 12.3 million individuals, which is a 62% increase in enrollment in essentially 2.5 years. So I think when you, just from an operational standpoint, you think about how you added 62% of an increase to a system that is very complicated and extremely diverse with a very challenging set of populations. It really is stunning that we were able to both grasp and embed the Affordable Care Act into our state program the way that we did, especially on such a short amount of time that we had, and given the state's resources when we were doing such an implementation. The other thing that I want to highlight is that, and it's not a fact that has changed before or after the Affordable Care Act, is that we in Medi-Cal today pay for approximately half the births in the state of California. So there's approximately 550,000 children born in California every single year, and we provide coverage to the moms and babies that are about half of those are born under a Medi-Cal coverage and payment scheme. Today, about 50% of all the children in California are on Medi-Cal. So if there's, according to the Department of Finance, if there's approximately 9.6 million kids in California, we have just a shave under 5 million of those children with us. And so that is both important to know, but also key to some of the decisions and policies that we want to think about, which is, if these are children that otherwise wouldn't have coverage with us, what are we doing to make sure that they are healthy and obviously able to go to school, learn, get their education, because you want them to go on and be, hopefully you don't want them on Medi-Cal, you want them, you know, on their own and supporting themselves and either with employer-based coverage or other types of coverage. Lastly, the Affordable Care Act in an enrollment setting, children dropped by 10 percentage points. So the program before the ACA and after the ACA, children made up about 55% of the overall population in Medi-Cal. And then after the ACA, where we stand today, they've dropped down to 45%, and adults have increased up to 55% of the program. And I think, obviously, as many of you know, that comes as a result of the adults that had no other linkage to Medicaid, otherwise not eligible for the program, becoming eligible. I think many of you were aware of the waiver that we had in 2010 that the Medi-Cal program had in place to provide an early expansion of coverage to the uninsured adults. And so I'm looking out there if anybody knows about the LIP program, and I know the foundation certainly supported a lot of the counties and their local health programs. This was a coverage to about 660,000 adults as a early part of the expansion of the ACA, and when we transitioned them on a single day, how many of you remember the press coverage around that transition? And well, Norman does because he works at the department, so that doesn't count. But most people don't remember seeing that transition in the press, and the reason that they didn't see it in the press is because it was a resounding success, and it is something that I think we are really proud of as we look forward, you know, to the next 5 years of the waiver that we're seeking with the federal government. Is the ACA and the waiver that we got in 2010 as a department and as a program was all about the early implementation of the Affordable Care Act. What can we do as a state to make sure that we put this program into place and provide coverage to the millions of Californians that need it? And that early wave of individuals on January 1st of 2014 were transitioned into coverage, and pretty seamlessly, and it was a remarkable both early adoption of the ACA from a state perspective. No one else flipped 660,000 people into a program on a single day, but the fact that they had already been receiving care through an organized delivery system also spoke volumes as to how those people found their medical home, how they already had a provider established, and many of them were already under treatment, which I think is also remarkable in that it probably helped the overall health delivery system absorb them better because they had been in coverage that previous 2 years. And then lastly, the largest transformation of Medi-Cal, again, prior to the ACA, and it has been a slow and steady phased-in approach, has been the increasing number of individuals that are enrolled in managed care versus fee-for-service. So today, about 80% of our population is in managed care, 20% is in fee-for-service. Back in 2007, it was 50-50. And really what we've got left now is about, so we have about 9.2 million individuals in Medi-Cal managed care plans throughout the state, a little around 3 million in fee-for-service. Those individuals that are in fee-for-service, by and large, are individuals without full scope coverage, either due to their lack of documentation status, so they may be with us through our emergency Medi-Cal program. They may have limited benefits. They may be there for pregnancy-only coverage. They may be populations that are exempt from Medi-Cal managed care, or they've received what we call a medical exemption request from managed care. A lot of those individuals may also be dually eligible, so individuals with both Medicare and Medicaid coverage, if they're not in one of our coordinated care initiative counties. And so that, I think, is kind of the challenge going forward as a state, as we look into this next year or so with the Affordable Care Act, which is how do we ensure that the coverage individuals are receiving in managed care is both accessible and meaningful, but then I look to the fee-for-service system and say, what are we doing for those individuals? Because they have coverage through Medi-Cal, but it is obviously not the same as our managed care plans. And so to the extent that individuals enrolled in a Medi-Cal managed care plan are entitled to certain things that our state has in place as a regulatory and legal scheme in terms of, you know, plans have to have primary care providers assigned to all of their beneficiaries. We have time and distance standards in this state that plans are held to, which, as far as I'm aware, no other state has timely access standards the way we do. I think that that is a completely both appropriate and measurable system that we are really both continuing to refine, but also incredibly comfortable with, and that we feel that that is the better way to provide care to people in an organized delivery system. But the next challenge that I see both as a department and as a program is what do we do about our remaining fee-for-service population, because their care is truly unmanaged, and that presents a lot of challenges both for their own health status as well as the financial ramifications of having individuals without any kind of either regular or comprehensive benefits afforded to them. The last thing I want to note, as we are getting ready to engage with the federal government in negotiations over our next 5-year Medicaid waiver, is we, you know, the waiver expires on October 31st. It was sold as the bridge to reform to the federal government, meaning help us do an early adoption of the ACA and provide us the federal funding, which was approximately $10 billion in federal funds, to show you how we can do this. And I think that we have absolutely delivered on that promise. But what we're talking to the federal government about now, which is we need another 5 years to fully embed this law into California and to really transform the delivery systems that these millions of Californians rely on. And I'm also mindful of the fact that it's not just Medi-Cal beneficiaries that rely on the Medi-Cal program. In a lot of different settings, the funding that Medi-Cal provides to certain facilities and to certain providers benefit all of us. And so I look to some of you who are experts more than I in this area in terms of our safety net financing, to our UC hospitals, to our tertiary care centers, to individuals that are familiar with our California Children's Services Program. If you look at the children's hospitals in the state of California, if you've ever visited a UC or had any kind of interaction with our academic research facilities, a lot of those programs, those facilities, that funding comes as a result of what Medi-Cal is able to do as one of the largest purchasers in not only the state, but also in the country. And so our story to the federal government as we look to this next 5-year waiver is we have done a really good job with the first 5 years of this waiver, and we need another 5 years to transform the system, but watch what we can do to better integrate care for individuals in our program. I have my May is Mental Health Awareness pin on if any of you are tracking this, but I think the next 5 years for our waiver is really kind of making sure that individuals have coverage that is fully comprehensive and is not just about their physical health, is that for a lot of individuals, when they see a provider, they may be also struggling with behavioral health issues, either mental illness or substance use disorders. And so I think that that's really what we're trying to tell the federal government is if we don't look at the whole person when they come into a provider's office, be it a behavioral health provider or a physical health provider, if we're not providing them a comprehensive benefit across the spectrum, they will continue to have poor health and they will continue to cost the system money that otherwise could be used for other purposes. And so I really am both impressed with what we've done as a state, but I think that we have set just a real benchmark for the rest of the country. And so, you know, more on this as we negotiate our next waiver with the federal government. And I'm going to stop for questions, comments. Don't be shy. Yeah.
So I'll start off, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. And so there's a microphone over there if folks want to come over to the mic and use and ask a question. And we'll ask you to state your name and your affiliation if you have one for the webcast. So Jennifer, you were appointed director of the department near the end of the second Affordable Care Act enrollment period. So I'm wondering, from the department's perspective, how did that go, and how are you thinking about enrollment and retention issues and challenges this year? Because last year there was quite a backlog of Medi-Cal applications that I think you've worked through. Mm-hmm. But how's it going this year, and how are you seeing the enrollment and retention questions?
Okay, interesting question. I think, like all things, when you do a big implementation in California the way that we did, there are certain things and circumstances that you can control and certain things that you can't. The IT system that we built in about 2.5 years in California is really a testament to the fact that it was an IT system that we built from scratch to do really complicated things that no one in the country actually knew what they were building to. And so, you know, you saw a lot of state exchanges and other states fundamentally fail in their ability to deliver the needed IT system to get the job done. And we did that in California, which was pretty phenomenal. And I see one person in the audience that has way more knowledge on this than I. But I think that when people flipped the switch on October 1st of 2013 to see if it would even turn on, I think there was maybe a little bit of nervousness. That being said, I think that the system that we built, otherwise known as CalHERS in California, certainly was new and immature as a system, and as a result, we had a lot of IT challenges between us as the state and the county consortium of eligibility systems, and that unfortunately led to a pretty significant backlog. We have worked through that backlog, but I think that eligibility and enrollment still continues to be a challenge, in large part due to the fact that we just have a significant volume of individuals that are on this program, and Medi-Cal eligibility being what it is, a lot of those individuals have to be annually redetermined for coverage. And so when you think about it, there's maybe 15 to 17,000 eligibility workers in the state spread through the various 58 county welfare director offices. Those 15 to 16,000 individuals have to annually redetermine basically 12 million Californians. And just think about how much of a intensive workload that is, because these are individuals that have changes in circumstance, changes in family size. Their income is probably not as easy as some of us in terms of they may have 3 or 4 different jobs. They may have income that is self-produced or produced, you know, on an hourly basis. It may be temporary, it may be short term, and I think trying to make sure that these individuals are entitled and found eligible for the program has been a really, really challenging thing. So that needs continued refinement. That system has about a 2-year roadmap that we have developed that says all of these functionalities still need to be refined and improved, and I'm hoping that at the end of 2 years, this is an easier process than it has been in the last couple of years. I would also say that the churn factor is just going to be one of those things that we have not reached a steady state in enrollment in California yet as far as Medi-Cal. We still are seeing increases every month in our enrollment, which means that there are individuals for a variety of reasons that are still finding their way to our program. And so that is also starting to show the data on the Covered California side, is how are we doing the transition between Covered California, which is most likely where these individuals are bouncing between, which is subsidized coverage, heavily subsidized coverage because of their low income income status, and if they lose a job or they lose a few hours on a job, that will all of a sudden make them eligible for Medi-Cal. And so those transitions and that churn that we refer to is going to continue to be difficult to fully process in another year. And so I'm hopeful that we will have a better handle on what that actually looks like, but I think that's one of the more significant challenges that we as a state and the county still have, is kind of understanding that transitory population and how they move so quickly between coverage, and that does pose its own challenges for continuity of care and other things.
Great, thank you. So, question over here.
Yes, thank you. This is Gabrielle Lassard from the National Immigration Law Center. At the last stakeholders meeting, you hadn't had a response from CMS on the waiver proposal, and I'm wondering if you've received a response since.
No. That's a great question. We have had unofficial, conversations, because we talked to CMS for a lot of things. They are hoping to get waiver comments to us probably in the next week or so. I think that they had wanted to do it sooner. There are two states that are up for major waiver renewals this year, us and Florida. And two different states we could not more be. And so what's happening in Florida is very different than what's happening in California, but the same people at CMS that are working on Florida also have to work on our waiver. And so I am hopeful that we probably get, some pretty detailed questions and comments, and then we can just start to march through it. But they have been really receptive in the first opening discussions that we have had with them. They like the fact that we are continuing to talk about value-based purchasing. They like the fact that we are incorporating kind of a comprehensive proposal to address individuals' needs on the spectrum of physical, behavioral, social need. They haven't said what they think about our housing proposal, but I think that's one of those revolutionary concepts that, if an individual doesn't have a stable housing situation, how are they expected to be on top of all of their healthcare needs as well? And so I think it's going to be a fairly productive conversation with the federal government, and certainly very, very different than what's happening in Florida, which is Florida says, give us a bunch of money for the uninsured, and CMS is saying, you could expand your Medicaid program, so why would we give you money to cover your uninsured costs when you could just increase your Medicaid, population? So we obviously have a completely different situation in California, which is we've increased, and so we just continue to need help to refine what we've already built.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Lola Acosta of Healthcare for All Sacramento Valley, and I am really interested in Senator Lara's bill, Senate Bill 4. Should it clear both houses of the legislature and be signed by the governor, I wonder what challenges that would pose for implementation.
So like any kind of population change or beneficiary change in the state, and I think what you just heard a little bit from me as in terms of how we implemented the Affordable Care Act, there are so many different things that we as a state have to do when you add a population. There are systems changes, there are a lot of state plan amendments or waiver changes that we have administratively with the federal government. We have an increasingly complicated financial arrangement between us and the counties for purposes of sharing costs associated with the Medicaid program. So I actually probably am breaking out in a sweat starting to think about how complicated it would be to add a completely new population to the state in terms of both the systems and the programmatic and the financing. That being said, I would just note that our budget allowed for a certain increase in funding related to the DACA and DAPA immigration changes issued by executive order under President Obama, and that was built on a kind of a estimate of our best guess as to should that be done, how many individuals in California do we think would fall under that particular immigration declaration, as well as how many do we think would actually take up the rate. And I think anything related to both Senator Lara's bill or other proposals, is it's always very complicated for us to understand the behavioral patterns of whether individuals would actually seek care or not. And so I think the costs associated with a complete expansion of individuals that are not currently served today would be challenging just for us to financially understand how they would behave, especially if their immigration status is still unknown. Because I think there's individuals in Medi-Cal today that receive emergency Medi-Cal coverage on a month-to-month basis. Some individuals may not even come into that program because they're worried about what happens to them on an immigration change or status, or coming into a system that would otherwise try to track them. And so, you know, we don't have an official position on that, but there are a lot of programmatic and administrative changes that the department would have to make, you know, both from a benefit standpoint as well as just accepting new beneficiaries.
Hi, my name is Ben Avey, and I'm with the California Primary Care Association. Today's report spoke to the importance of community clinics and health centers in the post-ACA world, and I was just wondering if briefly you could talk about where you see community clinics and health centers moving forward and as a part of the post-ACA world.
Okay, great question. I think that when you think about all the different ways that individuals seek care in California, and especially low-income populations or minority populations where they may not be comfortable seeking care through kind of the more traditional coverage sites, I look at our FQs and our community-based clinics, and you look at the different ways in which they serve their local populations. And our numbers in California and in the Medi-Cal program show how many individuals actually rely on FQs and rural health clinics for their care. And I think it is one of the ways in which we are keeping an actual network together in California. I know that the health plans rely on those FQs and RHCs and community clinics as well, in part because individuals are comfortable receiving care in health clinics. Oftentimes there's providers there that speak the language that they speak, and that makes them more willing and able to seek the care. And I know that the data that was presented earlier was that there were some individuals that were like, I'm not wanting to seek care because I don't feel that the provider can talk to me in my own language, or I'm uncomfortable in the waiting room or something. And I think the FQs and clinics have gone a long ways in really adapting their modalities to reach out to those hard-to-reach populations and make them feel as if they have a place to go. And I think the data just supports that, which is those individuals that were getting care in clinics before the expansion and they're still there after, they may have been uninsured in your clinics before 2014, and now they're actually with a coverage card, but they're still in your clinic. And I think that that speaks volumes to the fact that they, you know, made their medical home there, and that's where they continue to receive it. And I think especially in rural areas, sometimes the FQHC is the only provider, and that's a really important foundational key linkage to care in communities that don't otherwise have other providers up there. And so we would see them as being a fundamental partner going forward, as well as what they have done for us in the past.
Yeah, my
Thanks,
name is
and Hugo. I'm afraid this will have to be the last question for Jennifer.
My name is Hugo Morales, and I'm the executive director of Radio Bilingue. We're a Latino public radio network, nonprofit, community radio. And I'm also a commissioner for First Five Fresno County. And I wanted to ask you about, so we're the only ones that have a statewide interactive radio show dealing with health in California. So we've been monitoring for several years this, the ACA. And one of the things that we've been hearing last year was the long waiting periods for enrolling in Medi-Cal. So I was wondering whether you had any, I have three questions about, you know, the waiting period at this time for that. Also what we're hearing is that folks continue to not know what is covered under Medi-Cal. And then another is that there's a lot of misinformation, or maybe not, about some of the consequences of getting enrolling and benefiting from coverage under Medi-Cal. I have the concrete example of a former employee who for years waited not to enroll, to the reason why. And finally, she did enroll, and right now she's diabetic and has a foot infection. And so she's bedridden. And one of my managers visited her last week and asked her what worries her. And she says, well, besides the ailment, is that she's fearing that Medi-Cal will take away her home, and she lives in the barrio in Fresno. So these are my questions.
Great. So first, I'm trying to remember the enrollment question. And so it goes back to some of my comments earlier is I think, you know, the volume and the vast uptake at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act in California certainly not only overwhelmed the IT system, but it also just overwhelmed all of us, both from a workforce standpoint as well as from a state program standpoint. And so we have worked mightily, and you know, kudos to the county eligibility workers that also had to work that backlog, because they were, I know, pulling in a lot of manpower and overtime to make sure that individuals that wanted coverage could actually get coverage. And I know that that was like their first priority as well as it was ours. I think that there are still some delays, but probably not as many as people would think. I believe that a lot of the delays in eligibility enrollment these days are from individuals that may not have all the right pieces of information that they have to provide, and if they are waiting for either an income or a documentation status, those are sometimes reasons why their eligibility is delayed. I think there's also still continues to be some systems challenges. I do know that we have a lot of duplicate applications where someone will send in an application through our system electronically, and I'm, you know, making up a name, Bob Smith. And then if he doesn't hear back from the county whether he's been found eligible or not, he may submit another application entitled Robert Smith. And then if that doesn't get a response, then Robert Smith may be Robert R. Smith. You know, so there's a lot of duplicate applications, and we know that's a problem that we have to fix. And that just kind of adds to some of the county's workload, as they have to kind of sort through some of these duplicate applications and make sure that they are working on the one person that has actually applied. I think that your example of someone having delayed onset challenges related to their diabetes is a classic case for why we were so proud of the low-income health program under the waiver, is that we believed, and I think this bore out, is that individuals with chronic conditions, if they don't receive treatment in a more appropriate and timely manner, hopefully through a primary care home, that it worsens, and then we are left with a condition that is far worse in terms of outcome, as well as you know, cost to a system where those otherwise could have been avoided through a better provider in a lower level of setting. I think that, you know, we try as much as we possibly can to communicate with beneficiaries in their own language. So we translate all of our applications, all of our documents, all of our welcome packets into all of our Medi-Cal threshold languages. I don't quote me on the number, but I think that somewhere between 13 and 18 are our threshold languages in California for how we communicate with recipients. The plans, if an individual is enrolled into their Medi-Cal managed care plan, they receive a welcome packet from the plan, which is both their card, which, you know, entitles them to, you know, see that they have coverage and they can show it to a provider, but the welcome packet also includes the list of benefits that are available to them in Medi-Cal. And so, you know, to the extent that you have information that you want to provide to us after this, for individuals that say we don't know what those benefits are or we're not sure what Medi-Cal can do for us, I think that we are always looking for ways to better communicate what Medi-Cal is, how we provide coverage, and doing it in a way that is responsive to the recipient's cultural and linguistic needs, because not everybody receives information in this in a certain way. And I know Richard had done a study a few years ago on seniors and persons with disabilities, and we talked about ways in which they preferred to receive information, and a lot of them said, we don't want to get a call, we want to see it in the mail. And then if you talk to other populations in Medi-Cal, they say, well, we don't want to get it in the mail, we want to get a call, or could you text us, could you email us, are there ways that we can? So each segment of our Medi-Cal population prefers different communication strategies, and we are always endeavoring to do that in a better way. But again, it's a program with 12 plus million people, and so every day is a challenge. So, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer. So, now let's turn to a panel of dynamic leaders who've been deeply involved in Affordable Care Act implementation and get their observations on the study and how the ACA is going in California. So I'd like to call them on up here. So joining us are Genoveva Islas, the program director of Cultiva La Salud an organization dedicated to creating healthier communities in the San Joaquin Valley. As of March, she was also appointed by Governor Brown to be a member of the Covered California Governing Board and is, I'm sure, on a very steep learning curve there about how that works. Also joining us is Carmela Castellano Garcia, the president and CEO of the California Primary Care Association, which has a membership of more than 1,100 nonprofit community clinics and health centers serving more than 5.6 million patients a year. And then finally, Sarah DeGuia, the executive director of the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network, which is a multicultural statewide advocacy organization that works to improve the health of communities of color in California. So first off, let me turn to Genoveva. Since you come to the Covered California Board with a strong history of working to improve the health of low-income and Latino communities, especially in the Central Valley, so I'm wondering from your perspective, both where you work and as a board member, kind of how successful was the second open enrollment season and what challenges are on your mind looking forward?
Thanks, Richard. First, before I begin my remarks, I just want to say that it's always been my dream that Latinas would be recognized for their brilliance. And happily, I'm on a board of a panel today of all Latinas. So I just want to say we're making progress. Secondly, I want to thank you for recognizing that I've only been on the board since March and really only have about two board meetings under my belt. So yes, I'm on a very steep learning curve and I'm really still trying to learn the history and some of the decisions that have been made before my appointment. But as a sort of broad sweeping statement, I want to say that there are many successes to celebrate with Covered California, and I can think of 1.3 million. 1.3 million is the number of consumers that have active health insurance as of March 2015. And to date, Covered California has served 1.8 million Californians since it began offering coverage in January of 2014. During the second enrollment period, Covered California enrolled nearly 500,000 people. And the mix of enrollees are definitely more diverse and younger. New enrollment of subsidy-eligible Latinos surged 6 percentage points from 31% to 37% this year. And that's in alignment with the CalSIM estimates of Latinos at 38%. Similarly, African-American enrollment also rose from 3% to 4%. And that's also in line with the CalSIM estimates. And also, finally, young adults surged from 5% points to 29% points, from 29, I'm sorry, to 34, so 5 percentage point surge. I think at Covered California, we understand that we're not done and that we've certainly learned a lot during the first and second enrollment periods. But I think it's fair to say that we're headed in the right direction. In terms of challenges, I think that we need to continue to keep costs down. I see that as one of the foremost challenges. Covered California now is going into negotiation with health plans for its 2016, and we'll be announcing carriers and prices in late July. And this is incredibly important because as an active purchaser, we're looking to hold their feet to the fire, so to speak. Not only to provide consumers with the best prices, but also with the best access to doctors and hospitals. And then I think, you know, one last remark I want to say in terms of challenges overall that, you know, speaking as a Latina and speaking as a child of farm laborers, I'd be remiss if I didn't call out that one of the greatest failings of our system is that it doesn't allow the enrollment of all Californians into all Californians to enroll, specifically undocumented immigrants, into the Covered California. And to be clear, I don't want to imply that this is a failing of Covered California. I think, again, it's a larger failing in terms of the design of the system. And, you know, as we sit here, my mind is definitely on the 3 to 4 million Californians that remain uninsured. And my mind is also on the fact that in appropriations, we're hearing Senate Bill 4 today. And my wishes are that we create a system that is fair and accessible to all Californians.
Great. Thank you. So next, let me turn to Carmela. So the report clearly highlights the importance of clinics and health centers as core providers for low-income Californians. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, how are clinics adapting to attract and retain Medi-Cal and covered California enrollees by being their provider of choice?
Well, I want to start by saying I'm having a good day. I heard SB 4 did pass out of appropriations, coverage for the undocumented, as well as CPCA's other bills, so I'm feeling good. But I walked in here before I knew that, really feeling good about this report. Because I can remember back in 2011, sat on a lot of panels with Anthony Wright and, you know, Sarah and all of us doing the rounds of people asking about what was going to happen to the community health centers as a result of the ACA. And being the eternal optimist that I am and knowing my constituency well, I predicted very consistently that community health centers were not only going to retain their population, but they are going to grow. And I'm very pleased about the results of this report because it reaffirms with hard data what I predicted would occur. Why has that happened? Why are we providers of choice? I think we've achieved that. The data shows it. And I think for years we've been actively transforming ourselves so that we can deliver the quality care that our patients deserve in the manner that they prefer. And so we're seeing the results. Another study that Blue Shield released in January about advances in healthcare for low-income California showed that there was a significant increase among low-income communities in terms of patient satisfaction with the care they're receiving at community health center. So the data shows, and the kind of efforts that we have made. I mean, it's everything from the fact that we have a focus on whole person care. As just an article yesterday in the Public News Service about that, showing that at community health centers, it goes well beyond primary care into mental health, dental, counseling, eye care, and even further referrals for domestic violence, food and shelter, all happening under one roof. So for low-income Californians, that's extremely valuable. We want them to stay healthy. Our patient-centered approach is, of course, critical, which means that we have providers on our team, everything, not just physicians, but nurses, care coordinators, promotoras, outreach workers, and more, standing alongside the providers to meet the diverse needs of our population. And certainly, the data also shows for the Medi-Cal new enrollment, they do have important healthcare needs, and so it's critical that we're able to provide this kind of services. Certainly when it comes to advances in technology, I mean, 95% adoption of the electronic medical record for community health centers in California and nationally. So staying at the cutting edge of technology, adopting patient portals, being involved in health information exchange, these are the ways that we show our patients that they can connect to us. And certainly on the legislative front, we are really looking at changing our reimbursement methodology so that it actually incentivizes alternative approaches and things like email and phone and group visits and the kinds of things that our patients want. So we're going to continue to innovate. We're going to continue to be leaders, and therefore I think we will continue to be providers of choice, which we have also packaged into our branding initiative, which is California Health Plus, and that is the name of the statewide network of community health centers that take their obligation to see the newly insured very seriously, are committed to high quality care for their community, and California Health Plus is the brand that we are adopting statewide to really showcase the plus in healthcare that we provide that I just really shared that makes us the provider of choice.
Great, thank you. So now on to Sarah. From your perspective as an advocate for consumers and ethnic communities, what did the second open enrollment season look like to you, and what are you hearing from communities around the state?
Yeah, so, you know, just as a comparison from the first and the second enrollment period, I mean, as the report shows, there were some communication issues. And also from the enrollment figures, we know that the enrollment wasn't as great, particularly for the Latino and African American communities. You know, thanks to support from the Blue Shield of California Foundation, CPEN was able to work really closely with a number of certified enrollment entities who were firsthand enrolling people and could communicate those challenges directly to Covered California and the Department of Healthcare Services. So things like the website glitches, long wait times, inaccurately translated materials, they were all able to address those pretty real time. And so it was able to help enrollment along the way. And I think that served as a platform for lessons learned as Covered California and Medi-Cal move forward into the second, or Covered California move forward in the second enrollment period. So, you know, on a positive side, I think we saw that the targeting of outreach and marketing materials to the Latino and African American communities really did pay off. As Veva showed, the numbers for African American anecdotes was really close to what the CalSIM estimates were. But we also know that there's still a lot of work to be done. So three things that I think I would really point out that are very tangible things that we can be working on. Number one is really acknowledging the role of the certified enrollment counselors and the navigators. That they provide much more than just enrollment assistance, that they're there for all of the follow-up calls and questions. We have CECs who have spent up to 11 hours with one consumer helping them work through enrollment, making sure that they're getting enrollment, making sure that they understand their plans. Because a big part of this is, you know, people are just, they enroll in a plan, but they don't know how to utilize the system. They really don't understand the difference between co-insurance and co-payments. And so these are the folks on the ground without a lot of funding and resources who are able to help translate that information. And they literally are translating that information and interpreting that information from languages that are, you know, up to 13 Asian languages in some cases. So I think we really need to make sure that we understand and that are we're compensating the individuals who are helping. We also noticed that there's a real need for disaggregated data. So it's great that we're breaking it down by race, ethnicity, but we need to go even further. We really sort of picked the low-hanging fruit in the first round of enrollment. We saw 1.3 million enrolled individuals. And I think in the second round, in the second and third series of enrollments, we're probably not going to see those sheer numbers. Because these populations are going to be harder to reach. They're, again, languages besides English, individuals who, again, may not have any real understanding of how to use the system. They're sort of farther away. They need greater touches along the way. And so I think the disaggregated data would really help us understand where to target the resources to be able that we're making sure that we're enrolling those eligible populations. Also, just to note that enrollment in the API, the Asian Pacific Islander community, actually went down from 23% in first enrollment to 18% in the second. So kind of tied to my first point is that we do need to continue to invest in enrollment and assistance. That this, we're seeing sort of a disinvestment in outreach and enrollment from $30 million down to $10 million in the year 2015-2016 enrollment period. And again, you know, with the harder populations to enroll, knowing that we need to actually provide that greater material in other languages, that these are going to be populations who just need that greater assistance. We can't afford to disinvest in this enrollment periods. We need to really ensure that we're continuing that level of investing in the infrastructure that can help people who are already enrolled understand their coverage as well as get those harder to reach populations.
Great, thank you. So my next question is for Genoveva, although I invite the other panelists to chime in as well. So the survey shows that 44% of Covered California enrollees are still reporting difficulty paying their monthly premium as compared to, say, a quarter of adults with other types of coverage. So are you concerned that people gaining coverage now will be losing it in the coming years because of cost? And what are your thoughts about how this could be addressed?
So I think that, you know, this is a larger societal issue in terms of equitable pay, right? And I'm really happy about the progress in trying to increase the minimum wage. But sort of more specifically in terms of Covered California, I think it is vital that we work to try to keep costs down. Covered California does fight. We do negotiate on behalf of our members with insurance companies. And I think through our combined membership, we have a very large purchasing power. You know, one person perhaps can't do a lot to affect this, but 1.3 million, you know, is powerful and can. So I think that's one thing. You know, we're unique in that most of our consumers receive financial assistance to bring health insurance within their reach. And in fact, about three-quarters of all subsidized enrollees, that's roughly 912,000, pay less than $150 per member per month for health coverage. And some 120,000 pay less than $10 per member per month, right? So that's good news. But, you know, we do understand that healthcare in this country is still very expensive, and it's going to take time to bring down those costs. And while subsidies are important, this survey released validates the fact that healthcare costs are a challenge for many covered California consumers, as they are for many with private health coverage through their employer. And in fact, as mentioned in the report, covered California enrollees face costs that were higher than expected, which compares to 29% in the other private market. So I think, you know, definitely work to do there.
Oh, definitely concerns around the affordability issue, and the way it plays out in our health centers is to see folks with the bronze plan coming in and trying to use a sliding fee scale. So it really is an issue. We're seeing it. Our clinics are telling us that it's a problem and challenge, and we're pleased to see progress made at the exchange, you know, last week on the prescription drugs issue, and we would just encourage more consideration on these matters.
So in terms of affordability, I mean, I applaud Veva's comment. There's definitely an equitable pay issue, obviously. And I think there's also some changes that, you know, we should be pushing on the federal government as well to be looking at. So, for example, the family glitch, which is that employers are, whether or not an individual in the employee market can receive family coverage is based only on the individual, right? So if you as an individual can afford, if it's below the 9% of your income, you can afford it. It doesn't take into consideration the cost of dependent coverage. And so that's a challenge for a lot of families because that makes them ineligible for Covered California. So I think in terms of, you know, some affordability issues around, you know, there is some work to be done, you know, on the ACA, which we all knew. The other piece of it, I think, is also going back to the health literacy issue, which is that, again, I think people are not really understanding what their coverage is, and that maybe, you know, issues such as preventive care, right? We understand maybe what preventive care is, but somebody who maybe thinks that they're preventing care by going to get actual care from their doctor, like an eye infection or things like that, that actually isn't covered, that isn't free, people may not understand those differences. So I think a lot of work needs to be done about really helping people understand what their coverage is. There continues to be, I think, too, miscommunications between providers and their patients as well. So if a provider doesn't understand what a patient has coverage for, they may recommend a series of tests that the individual doesn't have coverage for as well, or that they don't understand what their procedures are. And so I think both the provider community, the plan community, and as well as consumers all need to be sort of on the same page about the type of care that people can get. You can't have an activated consumer if your plan and your provider aren't also a part of that conversation. So I think there really needs to be more engagement with both the government entities as well as the provider and plan community to help people navigate the system as well. And I think last but not least, you know, of course, health for all. We absolutely have to do something in California about covering individuals. So, you know, SB 4 has passed through appropriations. It's going to cover all kids, which is great. And it's going to cover eligible adults, or at least the proposal is to cover eligible adults as funding is available. So again, you know, there's the idea out there that we definitely want to cover people, but we haven't really stepped in fully in order to make sure that that is a reality here in California.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. So I think now I'll open it up to some questions from the audience. And there's the roving microphone. If you want have a question, raise your hand. Okay. And again, please state your name and affiliation if you have one.
My name is Kevin Hamilton. I'm with Clinica Sierra Vista. We're an FQHC here in California. Mm-hmm. We probably are a blip on the enrollment radar as well, having enrolled over 30,000 people here in the last year. And I think we've got some very unique things going on with our county government as well and Department of Social Services and some new experimental enrollment models and partnerships there. However, so we've got a couple of things. First of all, Covered California and CalHEARS are two separate entities and they talk separately. Yet both are troubled by the churning issue at the income breaks. So this needs to be incentivized from both directions. I wish the director was still here, but to seamlessly join those two systems, not just at that enrollment level, but the majority of the providers of managed care are also providing coverage in Covered California. So there is no reason not to have the plans migrate these folks back and forth and have that be transparent to the enrollee. The problem becomes when you get the enrollee involved in that part of the conversation, they lose it immediately. And why wouldn't they? I mean, we don't understand it ourselves half the time, and we're supposed to be fairly knowledgeable about these things. So that's one thing that I would suggest that we keep our sights on in the future. The other thing is, when we're talking about deploying CECs and deploying eligibility workers, again, we have about 35, oh, we have more than that, I guess. We have closer to 50 of them now in three counties. The funding that comes through for that, especially, again, on the Covered California side, is very numbers-driven. And we talked about this a few years ago. I talked about this a few years ago. And it was addressed initially, though I thought poorly, in the original outreach grants. The ones that are coming out now are still very numbers-focused. You know, the folks who live in Central California, the 4 million of us, you know, and those who live in Eastern California, the couple of million people there, and those in Northern California, we've got some significant geography issues. Those are, and we talked about this then, that geography should be considered at the same level as the numbers of people enrolled as a deciding point for how you're funding these things and the cost associated with that. If I have to send somebody 40 miles out to a town of 400 people, is that less valuable than sitting in an urban center enrolling 4,000? It isn't to them, and it isn't to us. So, and it shouldn't be to us as a state. So we really need to fix that. It's interesting because I just sent her a letter of support that I got from somebody for our new Navigator grant. But again, targeted at numbers. How many people can we enroll in Covered California? So I get it. I know you need the numbers, but it's not meeting the needs of these communities. And then the last thing is the cost issue. What we have discovered, and you should be informed by this conversation, as Carmela so eloquently stated a few minutes ago, in that range of people in health centers in sliding scale, when you're at 150% of the federal poverty line, given the cost of housing and utilities and groceries, and you're sitting there making maybe take home $1,500 a month, $1,600 a month, your rent for a two-bedroom apartment, and if you've got a couple of kids, you need a two-bedroom apartment, in Fresno, not in a nice part of town, by the way, is going to be $600 to $800 a month. Your utilities are going to cost you, by the way, that apartment doesn't have all the great insulation and the triple pane windows and the low energy footprint that newer places have. So again, we need to fix that. That's a huge problem. And we appreciate the subsidies. I think, you know, it's great at a certain point, but we really either need to raise that level or as a state decide we're going to raise the Medi-Cal minimum wage for qualification. So that's pretty much about it. So I would appreciate your
thank
comments.
Any comments or reflection?
I'm not going to argue with that because that's certainly the kind of information we are hearing from our health centers. And certainly the rural folks, not just in the Central Valley, but up north, have been saying all along that the funding formulas do not take into account the challenges that we have with outreach enrollment on the rural side. So, hear you.
It's kind of hard to have anything to address because I agree with everything that Kevin said, right? So definitely it is something of concern to us, the churning issue. And I think, you know, we're trying to be as proactive as possible to try to create a system that is seamless. It's not a quick fix, but I think we're looking in that direction. I've heard from a number of advocate organizations that, you know, are in not good situations in relation to how the initial grants were set up. I do think it's unfair. And I think, you know, there's conversations to be had in terms of how we fix it going forward. You know, as someone who's been born and raised in the Central Valley, yes, those 400 people in a rural community matter. They matter to me. And we want to make sure that, you know, there is service to them, right? And so whatever we can do to improve it and fix it, I'm for it.
Great. Thank you. Question over here.
Yeah, hi, Rick Johnson, Zero Divide. Question for you who work with navigators and enrollees. What, if anything, could Covered California do from a technology perspective to make the website easier for your navigators to enroll people into Covered California?
Translate them into other languages. I think the paper application, which was translated into, I think it was up to 13 languages, was, I think the sense was that the paper application was a little bit discouraged and that the online application was definitely encouraged. And so, again, sort of having folks be able to do it, you know, at their homes, but also working with other individuals who can help them enroll. You know, if that if that translation is done and they can look at it real time, it's much quicker to be able to enroll people in the coverages. I think the other piece was that there are, you know, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, for example, my colleagues down in LA, who received I think $500,000 this year to enroll a number of people. It was really numbers focused and they didn't meet their targets, and so I think this year the number's gonna go down, but they've actually took it upon themselves to translate materials into 13 different languages. So that's, you know, on their dime, or, you know, money that they have to put out of pocket in order to help the communities that they're serving. So I think, again, going to Kevin's point, I think all of the point, which is, you know, making sure that we're really investing in that infrastructure of people who are already helping to get people information about enrollment, but then again, who keep coming back to those communities to understand. And so I think there, you know, that point has definitely been made over and over again today. And I think, you know, in terms of also working with individuals, I mean, I think there's ongoing systems such as making CalHEARS a little bit more accessible, you know, the glitches that were happening at the website. The other point that I saw as I was looking through some of the stories is that not only do the CECs and the navigators, you know, have long wait times with Covered California, but they also have long wait times with the plans. And so they could be spending, you know, 2 hours just getting information from Covered California, but also from the plans. And so I think, again, sort of looking at the plans and the provider community to say, there are several language access laws that are already on the books, and so it's just really making sure that those plans and providers understand what their obligations are and that their infrastructure is in place to be able to meet the needs of their current enrollees, but also their potential enrollees as well.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? All right. The microphone's coming.
Yes, Hugo Morales on Radio Bilingue and First Five Fresno Commissioner. You know, as Carbella was alluding to the changes of the clinics, I was thinking about some of the challenges that the families face. There's 25% of California's families who do not have broadband at home. You know, as we, how would I say, upgrade and so on our facilities, you know, this, you know, 10 million Californians without broadband at home. And, you know, there's a real, I'm calling this out because there's an opportunity to address this. Right now, in the next few days, there'll be an opening opportunity to support the idea of providing Lifeline and defining Lifeline, you know, which is a subsidized service that has been just for telephone, and defining that as to include broadband. So there's a real opportunity here for those of us in the health field to support, you know, the introduction of broadband to 10 million Californians, which is the population, I think, that all of us here in this room are supporting. And I would hope that you can do that by going to the website internetforallnow.org and registering it there. So anyway, I just thought I alert people to that opportunity.
Great, thank you.
Can I just comment that the certainly the digital divide is an important issue that needs to continue to be considered, and I really think one of the successes of the community health centers was our role in providing that one-stop shop to the families, with over 2,000 certified enrollment counselors placed at community health centers throughout the state. Really played a critical role for the folks that couldn't take care and do this at home, and plus needed all the assistance with language and the complexity and everything else. And I think that is one of the important ways that we are helping to overcome that digital divide, with community health centers serving several million Latinos in the state of California, and certainly Spanish speaking, and half our patients speaking a language other than English. So these issues are critical for our population, and that's why having those certified enrollment counselors in the place where folks are receiving their care and being able to help them through that process, and to have the laptop at our end and not theirs, really made a huge difference. And it's something I'm very proud of. It was such a wise decision to make sure that the health centers, not only certainly in Medi-Cal, but in the exchange as well, because there was even a question at one point early on, you might recall, about whether health centers could be enrollers and be compensated for that. But wisely, that decision was changed, and it showed the success of needing that assistance for the very issues that you mentioned.
Thanks. Other questions? Just wanted to then ask one question of my own for Carmela to start with, but for the whole panel. So according to the survey, it did show that about 19% of newly insured adults who have a usual source of care reported that they changed the place they usually go for care since gaining their coverage. And most of the newly insured adults who changed their site of care reported that it was due to their insurance. So I'm wondering, Carmela, kind of what are your health center members experiencing in terms of churn and patients shifting to or away from the health centers because of their coverage? And the other panelists, if this is an issue that you're seeing as well in the communities that you're talking to.
What the data shows is that for community health centers, that folks stayed with the community health centers. And so we had excellent retention of our patients, and we were also attracting new ones. And I think these enrollment efforts that I mentioned were absolutely key to our success in being able to do that. I think it was very helpful to the patients. It made a lot of sense. It's all the changes that I already discussed that we had made that I certainly have made the community health centers providers of choice, and that is another reason why we were able to do so. And I think it just shows to the wise decisions that Congress made and the President in when passing the ACA, when they made an $11 billion investment in the expansion of community health centers, because I think it was predicted that this would be a model of care that the patients would choose, particularly the Medi-Cal population, which the data fully supports, as well as recognizing that we were going to continue to play a significant role in care to the uninsured, which is another piece that is very strongly coming out of this data, with 60% of the uninsured getting their care at community health centers. So we have 100 new access points in California as a result of this federal investment, so there has been a great expansion in our capacity. It doesn't mean, though, that we're not stretched thin to keep up with this increased demand. So one thing about being popular is that you got a lot of demand to meet, and you also have to keep up with patient expectations around access. There was a data point on wait times. The wait times is something that needs to come down and has and needs to continue to do so. So we are going to need to continue to transform and make the changes to attract and retain those patients. So out the gate, we're doing well, but in order to sustain it, community health centers are going to have to continue to innovate, continue to have to focus on patient engagement, patient satisfaction, care transformation. So nobody's resting on their laurels. We are looking at how we build on this success into the future.
So I think the majority of individuals who rolled either through Medi-Cal or covered California were from communities of color. And, so as we looked at the findings, and I definitely talked with Rachel too, is, what role is language and culture playing in people's choices as well? And we know that communities clinics often provide some of the best culturally competent care. And that there's other providers and networks who are also providing that culturally competent care. So as Director Kent mentioned, that we still have 20% of Medi-Cal beneficiaries who are enrolled in fee-for-service, we're starting to find that some of those may be staying with their fee-for-service providers because they're getting care from their providers who speak their language. They don't want to shift into a Medi-Cal managed care plan because they're not sure that they're going to be able to get those same doctors who speak those same languages. So I really think that language and culture plays a huge role in who people choose to be their providers, whether or not they stay or whether or not they change their providers. And we also have seen a little bit that people are delaying care to get services as well because they can't access those providers too, that the networks are very slim in terms of having providers who speak those languages. And so I think that plays a really key role, and I would love to see in future iterations sort of that teased out a little bit more. And just really helping us understand how can we ensure going forward that we really do have those services for those who are newly enrolled.
I'm not sure exactly the proportion, but I'm sure to some degree part of that shift in terms of where they're seeking care could be as a result of a change in circumstance and moving from, Medi-Cal to covered California. And so, to the point that was raised earlier, it does need to be seamless so that people aren't faced with those changes in their life circumstance, changing who their healthcare provider is or where they routinely go for care. So that is a concern to us. I think, when I think about some of this challenge, certainly in my geography, it does have a lot to do with an upstream issue, and that's how do we draw more providers, right? Like, how do we create a sufficient pool of providers to give our consumers the right care at the right time that they need? Again, I feel like that's part of the larger challenge, and that we need to think about how we are working in concert to make sure that everybody has access to the right providers. Interesting sort of tidbit from Covered California is that in terms of the evidence and the data that we're seeing, they're really the difference between Covered California and those with employer-based coverage are not statistically significant. And what this truly, I think, underscores is that too many Californians of all types with employer-based coverage and Covered California sometimes struggle to get the care in a timely way. And an important sort of good news here is that over 90% of both Covered California and employer-covered Californians report that they have locally accessible care. So I think that's, a positive.
Thanks.
Could I just, I'm so glad you mentioned workforce, because I was so remiss not to, because I think that is the next phase of the major, major challenge that not only the community health centers, but the entire health industry is currently facing and is going to continue to face, and is really getting to crisis proportions. In particular, the primary care provider shortage going well beyond physicians, because again, with the team approach, we've got physician assistants and nurses and nurse practitioners and many others, and particularly when it comes to cultural linguistic competent care. So the statistics that Latinos are 5% of physicians, which is what it was, if I'm not mistaken, 25 years ago when I first got involved in healthcare, is indicative of what a very serious crisis we're facing. So that'll be the next slew of panels I expect to be on going forward.
So I think we have time for one last question over here.
Sure. My name is Sam Cole. I'm with Keenan. And a question that I have is, we saw over the two open enrollment periods a growing market of individuals who are small business owners, self-employed individuals, farmers, whose income did not qualify them for a subsidy under Covered California, and we were directed to enroll them into Medi-Cal. When they go to Medi-Cal, they are declined because they own assets of some form, and so then they're pushed out into the open market and literally cannot afford it because of their financial situation. So I'm curious to see if there's any kind of a program involved. I've heard this is now up to about 1.2 million people in California who are falling into this chasm, and I would hope that at some point one of the agencies would try and address it.
Any comments on that?
So this I think is indicative of my learning curve still, because I know that there is a what used to be called the SHOP program, and Lieselda, I think it's been renamed recently to Covered California for Small Business. But I'm not specifically clear on sort of the eligibility for that, but my hopes are that some of these people falling through the crack as described, they're not able. So we need to.
And we also know that there's a number of small business owners who are immigrants and who are communities of color. And so it really is a huge issue, and I think a population that kind of tends to get overlooked. So I think we definitely look forward to continue working with Cover California and also with DHCS and the state to see, you know, if there are individuals who are income eligible, but because of the assets, if there's a way to look at state policy to make sure that these aren't individuals who are not penalized, right, for doing, you know, doing what they need to do, but who can't, unfortunately, afford health insurance.
All right. Well, thank you. Our time is up. So join me in thanking our panel. So what we've heard today really shows progress in improving health coverage and access for low-income Californians. But as you've heard, there remain significant issues with enrollment and cost, and we still have a lot of work to do. But this report helps show us where to focus our efforts in the months ahead. So again, I'd like to thank Rachel Garfield and the Kaiser Family Foundation staff for all the hard work they put into this report and into this briefing, as well as thank Rachel Wick and the Blue Shield of California staff for helping to shape the report and the briefing today. I'd like to thank DHCS Director Kent for her comments and our panelists for giving us a lot of great things to think about. So thank you all for coming.